Good morning, everyone. We are in Revelation 17, and we'll be taking a look at verses 7 and following. Our plan is to finish chapter 17 this morning, and next week we'll move into chapter 18. I don't have as many slides as normal, so I don't think that that will be much of an issue. I've already started chapter 17 as well, so I think we'll be all right in that end. Okay, so just one quick thing from last week, just by way of review. We had said that there's this big debate about the book of Revelation and who the enemy is, who the antagonist is in Revelation. Now, ultimately, everybody agrees that it's Satan, but there is some disagreement, even here in Louisville, among some congregations, about whether it's Jerusalem or whether it's Rome that is the current agent of Satan. And that's something that we're not digging into a whole lot in this class, but from time to time, I tried to kind of return to that and say, this is worth looking into and worth researching. I've argued pretty consistently that Rome is the current agent of Satan. I do believe that it's written pretty well after destruction of Jerusalem. Jerusalem's been pretty much nullified as far as its influence. There is an immense amount of evidence for that. All the early writers said that it was written during the reign of Domitian. Everybody. There's really no exception to that early on. There are things within the pages of Revelation that would indicate that too. The fact that John is on the island of Patmos, certainly the Jews in Jerusalem didn't put him there. So there are a lot of reasons to believe that this is Rome. And whenever we're engaging in a study of a book, we do want to ask questions about when it was written. We want to ask about who the main characters are. It's like any other book that you want to read. If you want to understand things that are going on, then you want to appreciate what's been written in that. And so Livy and I have been talking a lot this past week. We've started introducing a very basic Shakespeare into Julia's sort of learning. And so one of the things with Shakespeare, sometimes you have a hard time keeping up with the characters, the different characters that you're dealing with. And so you don't want to miss out on the storyline, so you want to understand who the characters are, when it's written, who it's written about. And that will help you. That can be sometimes a bit more of an academic study, more than we're used to in regards to, like, you know, what does Galatians 3:28 say? And answer this fill in the blank. You know, what's the third word in the verse? It's a little bit more than that. So it's definitely something you have to chew on a little bit. But I don't want to belabor this, but it is worth talking about. And there is some disagreement. So just kind of be aware of that. But you know, if you find somebody who takes a Jerusalem view, send them my way. I'll help you talk to them. We looked in chapter 17, verse 1. And by the way, if somebody takes a Jerusalem view, I don't think they're a heretic or something, and you shouldn't either. There are good reasons for taking that view. I think there are much better reasons for taking the Rome view. So, you know, don't blast somebody for taking a little bit of a different understanding. At the end of the day, who's the real enemy? Satan. And so whatever he's using, whatever instrument he's using, that's kind of what we have to think about. He is, you know, our flesh, or our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, forces of wickedness, that sort of thing that Ephesians 6 talks about. But again, just a few things about why it makes more sense to think of Rome as being the current issue, particularly in regards to chapter 17. Verse 1 of chapter 17, that one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, come here, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. Where is Jerusalem? It's kind of in like a mountainous region. It's not really on the water. And so to describe Jerusalem as sitting on the many waters wouldn't really be appropriate. Verse 4 says, the woman was clothed in scarlet and purple and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations and of the unclean things of her immorality. So two things here. One, Jerusalem at this point in history, even if you took an early view, even if you said that Revelation was in the 60s, Jerusalem is not, you know, gaudy royalty at that point in history. Maybe if you're writing like 500 or... you'd have to go back further than that, 750 years, 800 years before this, maybe, but not in the first century. And then the second thing about this immorality, and particularly sexual immorality is the word that's used here, that's not really Jerusalem in the first century. Now, Jerusalem in the first century has its issues. The Jews have issues, But as far as sexual immorality, that's not really the top of the list. Even if you were to take that from an idolatrous sort of figurative standpoint, in the first century, their issue wasn't so much idolatry, it was other things. And so it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to talk about this as being a description for Jerusalem. Verse 9, here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains or seven hills on which the woman sits. Seven hills, seven mountains. You know, there is symbolism there, and we'll get to that, and we'll talk about the symbolism there. But the symbolism is reinforced by the fact that Rome actually did sit on seven hills, and it was well known as a city on seven hills. So it has more punch when you think about it as Rome. Verse 18, last verse in chapter 17, the woman whom you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Jerusalem in the first century is not so much great city that rules over the kings of the earth. In fact, they are basically a subject of Rome. Not basically, they are a subject of Rome. All of their officials are Roman appointed, including, you know, some hands into the high priestly office actually too. So you've got Rome being overwhelmingly the agent that Satan is currently using in the first century. Now, clearly, there are a lot of combinations, a lot of drawing from the Old Testament. We talked about that with the whole book of Revelation. There's really two sources for the imagery. The Old Testament, what's the other one? Culture. The Old Testament and culture. Now, there are some descriptions in the Old Testament of Jerusalem that are recycled here. And again, that would be maybe a point on the side of the Jerusalem view. But again, overwhelmingly, Rome is the agency. Now, at one point, Jerusalem was very hostile. They were the chief enemy of Christians very early on. In particular, you got Jews in Jerusalem trying to stomp things out. Among them, Saul of Tarsus. But definitely a big source for the imagery. Now, where it starts to get a little bit tricky is not so much verses 1 through 6. You do have to debate whether it's Jerusalem or Rome. But in verses 7 and following, the imagery is so vivid and so intense that you have a wide variety of different views on things. We'll try to be consistent with the Old Testament. We'll try to be consistent with the culture and make sure that we're understanding these things to the best of our ability. And God says that we can understand, right? In fact, like in places, Ephesians 5:17 says, understand what the will of the Lord is. Understand is in the imperative, so that's a command. If we're commanded to understand what God's will is, can we understand God's will? Yes. Is it tricky sometimes? Yes. It can be difficult at times. Even Peter said that about Paul in 2 Peter chapter 3. So, let's go into this next section. You get towards the end of verse 6, when I saw her, I wondered greatly. Does anybody have anything different for that? Marveled. Great amazement. The language here is like, I marvel with great marveling. I am amazed with astonishment. It's a doubled up, coupled up sort of an idea. And so from John's perspective, we would say, how would you describe John in today's vernacular? He was blown away. He was amazed. His jaw dropped based on this. And there are a lot of different reasons for that, but the angel in this next section inquires as to why. So he wonders with great wonder. The angel asks why, and that leads into the angel's response and commentary. And again, that's been the source of centuries of different debates. Now, really, a lot of the questions revolve around these things. What or who are the seven heads or mountains or kings? What is meant by five have fallen and one is and the other has not yet come? And who are the ten horns and kings? There seems to be a distinction between them. So you're reading through chapter 17, you get to that. Would it be an accurate assessment to say that that is difficult? Do you read through chapter 17, you get to that point, and you're like, what on earth is he talking about? That's okay. That's a natural response to that. It definitely is very thick imagery. So let's kind of begin at the beginning. Let's have somebody read verses 7 through 11 to get all of that crazy imagery in front of us, and we'll break it down one thing at a time. Who wants to read verses 7 through 11? John Cullinan, go ahead.
Which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast that you saw was and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to the perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, those whose names are not written in the book of life, from the foundation of the world. And they see the beast that was and is not, and yet is. Here is the mind which has wisdom. Seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings, five have fallen. One is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth, and is of the seven, and is going to perdition.
All right, thank you. So you're going through this, and the first thing that may stand out to you is this phrase, who was, is not, and will ascend, or who is about to come out of the abyss. That comes up two times in this passage. What does that make you think of? It's a triplet. It's three different things being said about somebody. Who was, and is not, and will ascend. Yeah, it's got that same triplet sort of value where it's, you know, past, present, future sort of an idea. Absolutely, it makes you think of God. Andrew, did you have something to add?
Well, I was just trying to find these. Okay, verse 8 of chapter 1.
Yep, chapter 1, verse 8 says, I am the Alpha and the Omega, says the Lord God, who is and who was and who is to come, the Almighty. Robin? Yeah. Yeah, it's the Antichrist. I don't mean that with capital A. But it's something that's supposed to be understood as the very opposite of Christ. And that's what we've seen in the book of Revelation. All the good that God has done, Satan has. He is undone. He's tried to corrupt. Undone might be a little bit too strong, but he's tried to corrupt. He's tried to devalue. He's tried to mess with it. He's tried to invoke his own system into it. God gives a relationship and marriage a holy value, and Satan tries to twist that, and he says, well, let's do that outside of the relationship, and let's take on all sorts of perversity. So everything that God tries to give to us, or God does give to us, Satan tries to corrupt with all of his might, and that is definitely why you get this description of Satan and his forces was, the idea was, you know, powerful, will ascend out of the pit is, of course, he's in the pit, so he's been under condemnation. So he's earned his spot there. Andrew?
I like it right here that this messenger's angel is first comforting John with these words, saying this being has no power in comparison to God, and this message would be comforting to those Christians that were being persecuted, saying that, don't think it's sir, God is still very much in control. And there's such an extreme between God's power and this being's power, this instrument or figure of Satan.
Yeah. You bring up a good point. There's kind of a twofold aspect here where John is being comforted, because why is he on the island of Patmos? Does anybody remember? He's basically in prison. He's getting a little bit of license. He's more like house arrest, you might say. But he's on Patmos, which is a Sporades island. That's where Romans sent criminals. And so he's been relegated a criminal. Says he's there for the testimony of the Lord. And so he needs comfort, and those who are dying need comfort too, and they would be all the way up in Asia Minor. Not all the way up, it's 50, 60 miles to the coast from these Sporades Islands. So, but they both need comfort, and to make that sort of applicable towards us, do we receive comfort from the Scriptures? Do we receive direction from the Scriptures? Yes. Can we give comfort and direction towards other people from the Scriptures? Yes, there's always a twofold aspect of that. John Reeve, did you have something to add?
Sins out of the bottom of the pit, that he does so because God allowed it to happen. So, as we see the whole book, God is in control, and he influences the actions of people that reject him, but he always does it for his own purposes, but he's always the victor.
Yeah. A clear example would be Pharaoh, Romans comments on that, where Pharaoh is used to accomplish God's will, even though he's functioning as an agent of Satan. Good thought. Definitely an evil imitation of Jesus. We had looked at chapter 1, verse 8, but chapter 1, verse 4 makes much the same point as does chapter 4 and verse 8. So if you were to kind of consider this, it's like an evil Messiah is sort of the idea. And lowercase a, Antichrist. It rises from the abyss. That makes us think of chapter 9, chapter 11, chapter 20. We'll see that idea too with a 1,000 years sort of language there in chapter 20. Instead of the grave, Jesus rose from the grave. This evil Messiah is coming up from torment and to be destroyed rather than to reign. So this evil imitation of Jesus is destined for failure and destruction. Now, I thought this was a good thing to consider in regards to this language here. The persecution, the initiatives for persecution were sometimes ruthless and other times really non-existent. When you look at Roman history, you have some emperors that just absolutely loathe and despise Christians, and they will burn them at the stake, and they will kill them, and they will slaughter them. And then you've got others that don't really care. They're more interested in other things. And so there is this sort of ascending and receding, and that maybe is the idea that we're talking about here. Certainly under the reign of Domitian, the fires get lit again. And then under Trajan, things get awful. I mean, it was one of the worst persecutions that the Christians underwent. Later on, you might think of like under Decius or Marcus Aurelius, things got really bad under them. But there were also times when things weren't terribly bad for Christians. So it wasn't like the next 300 years is going to be full of murder and burning and pillaging and all that sort of thing. But a lot of it would be. John Cullinane.
More enlightened,
yeah,
and more aware, but this is going on today too, throughout the world.
Yeah, you can find videos online in the drop of a hat. Christians dying, Christians being killed. And so, definitely, we want to be thinking about the book of Revelation in these times, especially in regards to our own selves, in regards to our brethren who are suffering around the world. Now, you look at this harlot, this mother of harlots, and she's riding on the back of this great beast. That's terrifying. It's meant to be terrifying. But the reality is that despite its invincible appearance, it will find defeat and destruction. And that's what we have to consider. That's what David considered when he saw Goliath. The armies of Judah couldn't comprehend that. They couldn't see things from that perspective. And it's hard to see things from that perspective when we are undergoing suffering, our loved ones are undergoing suffering, when we know people are undergoing suffering. It's hard to see with that perspective. And kind of related to what John Reeb had pointed out is this sort of divine appointment, this divine allowance that evil would be given some reign, at least for a time, in order to accomplish God's purposes. God is good, and that's our foundation, that's our core. And also there is evil in the world. And God sees the end from the beginning. And that's really what we have to kind of bank our faith on, is that God knows best and God has a plan, and evil will not reign perpetually, is the idea. Evil, there will come a time where evil is completely dealt with. The time has not yet come while we live on this earth. A few other thoughts here on this section. This actually, if I remember correctly, this is from, this is an inscription, a wooden inscription that was used for Martin Luther's translation of the Bible. So I wanted to incorporate some of that throughout our class on Revelation to help us appreciate the history of a lot of these things and how impactful it has been for a lot of believers in the past. Revelation's stated intent from the beginning is to convey truth via symbols. These are signified. These are communicated with symbols. That's what Revelation 1, verse 1 tells us. Many try to force an exact listing of kings into this text. All such attempts end up in contradictions and inconsistencies. I think on the next slide I'll give you two examples of this. But some will start it with Julius Caesar, some will start it with Augustus, some will skip over minor emperors and just focus on the major emperors, some will include some minor emperors, some major emperors, and they'll throw out whatever they don't need. So there is this problem of trying to force into history a literal 7 and a literal 10. What have we seen with numbers in the book of Revelation? Particularly 7 and 10. They're symbolism. 7, completeness, perfection. 10, usually power there with 10. Completeness too, complete in the sense of power. So when we see 7, when we see 10, when we see 5 in this context, and overwhelmingly what we've seen in every chapter in Revelation is symbolic, how should we take 5, 7, and 10 in this passage? Symbolic, thank you. All right, so let's talk a little bit about that. I will say this in regards to symbolism. The challenge sometimes comes when a symbol does have a counterpart where something's literally true. And I think a good example of that is the Seven Hills. You could describe a city that is opposed to God in a lot of different ways. But one of the ways that was chosen was Seven Hills, Seven Mountains. Why? Maybe because there is a literal counterpart to that. And so that's where it starts getting a little bit tricky, a little bit difficult. Because sometimes a symbol is chosen because it has a literal counterpart. So that's where we get a little bit tricky. Now, mountains in the Bible are symbols of strength, right? God is a rock, a mountain in a time of need. God's kingdom is likened to bursting forth from a mountain in Isaiah 2 and Micah 4. Jeremiah, Babylon is like a mountain. Same thing in Ezekiel. Daniel 2, we have, of course, God's kingdom is this rock uncut by human hands, and it grows into a mountain. Zechariah chapter 4, we've got some symbolism there with the leaders of Zechariah's day. Particularly here, mountains as a source or a symbol of power or reign is connected to kings. And here in Revelation 17. And so we have to kind of analyze that and think about that. One more point about this before we get into the commentary of verses 12 through 17. The seven kings in verse 10 are distinguished from the ten horns or the ten kings in verse 12. There is a separation that's created there. And so if somebody is going to try and make a list, they're going to have to make two different lists, where you've got the ten kings, which are labeled as like client kingdoms versus chief rulers, I guess you might say, for the seven kings. You have to create two separate lists. And that's where I think sometimes this falls apart when people try to interject a literal understanding of kings into this. So here's an example of two separate lists. And the second one is more common. The first one has been argued by some, but I would say that the second one is more common. People try to bridge from Augustus, who was Julius Caesar's successor. He was the one that won out among the generals. He became the first legitimate emperor of Rome, although some people wanted to identify Julius Caesar as emperor. And this list will tend to go from Augustus down to Domitian, and the books written during the reign of Domitian. The problem with even that one, which has become more popular, is it skips over like four different emperors in order to get to that. They are minor emperors, like Otho and Galba and some of these other ones, Vitellius. So it skips over some of these and calls them minor emperors, not really a big deal. But again, if you're going to see something as literal, see it as literal. You can't just say something is literal and then just jump over wherever it proves your point. So we do not need to establish an exact correspondence between heads and emperors. We don't need to do that. Is it maybe an interesting exercise? Yeah, it's worth considering. But based on what we've seen with Revelation, the numbers have symbolic value. Now the trick is, here in this passage, not just because it lays out 7 and 10, which would be easy enough, you know, completeness and power and perfection. The trick here comes with this phrase. 5 have fallen, 1 is, the other has not yet come. And that's where people are really kind of motivated. That's the impetus to try and say, well, okay, maybe we are dealing with actual kings here. And I get that. And again, I say it's a worthwhile exercise, but I think we have to be consistent with the stated intent of Revelation. And so how do we understand this from a symbolic standpoint? I would argue that this is a symbolic note of promise that awful things have happened, are happening, and will happen. But when you have 7, 5 have passed, what does that tell you about the future? There's only 2 more. If 5 have already passed, you are most of the way there. And from the Christian's perspective, where it seems like this is never going to end, doesn't that seem fitting? That the vast majority has passed, there is some ugly stuff to come in the future, but you're almost there. Don't give up. I think that makes a lot more sense in regards to symbolism. So, things, awful things have happened, they are happening, they will happen, yet God will bring it to pass quickly, and the kingdom will press forward despite all odds. And specifically, John is leaning on the apocalyptic method of saying, the worst has passed us. We are almost there, brethren. I think that's more consistent with the symbolic state. I think it avoids all of the problems that come up with trying to project a literal idea into the text. Now, I'll give you one understanding of the literal sort of projecting into this text. Remember I said that this is the more common view? So according to that view, Nero would typically be the 5th one. Nero had fallen, right? Cut his neck and died. Now we have a new Nero, Domitian, because Domitian is following in the footsteps of Nero. He has become this icon of Rome, and he has persecuted Christians. He's going to continue persecuting Christians. That's how that's understood from that literal viewpoint. Is it worth looking at? Sure. And is it historically true? Sure. But that viewpoint, again, skips over minor emperors in order to accomplish that. So there are some issues that I see in regards to that viewpoint and that you will have to sift through in considering that. Now, the beast is an 8th king to be counted as one of the 7. That's one of those other things in this passage where you're like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? I think the best way to understand this is that the imagery overlaps. And that's what we've seen in Revelation. Sometimes with the portrayal of Jesus, you have a lamb, and then other times you have a lion. Sometimes the celestial beings are living creatures or cherubim or seraphim. Sometimes they're just called angels. Sometimes you've got angels presenting themselves as people. The language can be fluid, and that's okay. We have to be used to that. That's how they use this genre. That's how they wrote in this sort of literature. But at the time of writing, the current crown of the harlot was Domitian. We know that about 95, 96 is Domitian. He's going to die shortly after this, and Trajan's going to take over. But Domitian and Trajan really are the embodiment of the empire and its wickedness. And so it is very much like in chapter 13, verse 3, where you've got the fatal wound on the head, but he comes back. That's kind of that Domitian resurrection of Nero. Yes, sir. I have seen that viewpoint, but people argue inconsistently about who fits the bill. Is it Egypt? Is it Assyria? So you have to take a symbolic value for it. You have to say all rather than getting literal in the history of time. Yeah, I would agree with that. I've always seen what happens in Scripture as being illustrating a pattern in world affairs, a pattern that always happens, whether it be Egypt or Assyria or Babylon, whether it be the Medes and the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans. It's the same old, same old. The only thing I would say as far as being careful about that is, like I said, creating sort of a literal progression. I think you have to consider all these in sum.
I think, the kings could be kingdoms, right? I mean, when it says kings, it doesn't necessarily mean an individual king.
Correct, yeah. Correct. Yeah, I would be hesitant about creating a literal progression because there's all sorts of people that speculate about all sorts of different fulfillments of this. But yeah, I think you're right. There is a pattern in history of God's enemies, and they tend to engage in the same basic sorts of things. So that definitely could be a way of looking at this as well. One thing that's clear from this passage is that the beast and the kings have seen better days. They have seen better days. Their end is approaching quickly. So remember that the judgment of an enemy speedily was characteristic of apocalyptic literature, even when it took 100 years or 200 years, 300 years. When they're writing in this literature, it is God is going to come and he's going to strike them down. And it's just a short time away. That's consistent with even how the Bible uses the term in the latter days. We've been in the latter days for 2,000 years. We may be in the latter days for another 10,000 years. It may happen tomorrow. But God tells us to be prepared because Jesus will come like a thief in the night. And so it's consistent with how the Bible uses this language. Now, persecution will ebb and flow. All such efforts will lead to ruin and overthrow of ungodliness. It's kind of like what Jude says. He says that God will overthrow the ungodly because of their ungodly behaviors and their ungodly activities. It's sort of a threefold, corruption that happens there in Jude. It's very similar here that we're seeing. Let's read verses 12 through 17. This is the end of the chapter. Let's read 12 through 18 because that'll bring us right to the end. Who wants to read that for us? Not Tom or John. As much as I love them, I'm thankful for them. 12 through 18. Go ahead, Doug.
In the morning, when you saw 10 kings, there was no kingdom in authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind. They will give their power and authority to the beast. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called chosen and faithful. Then he said to me, the water which you saw, where the harlot sits, are people, multitudes, nations, and tongues. The 10 horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot, make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to fulfill his purpose, to be of one mind, to give the kingdom to the beast, until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman whom you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth.
All right, thank you, Doug. I appreciate it. So, you know, verse 16 really would make for a good children's Bible class. And the 10 horns which he saw and the beast, these will hate the harlot and will make her desolate and naked and will eat her flesh and burn her up with fire. That would be a good Bible class, wouldn't it? Very strong language here, very powerful language here. Verse 12, these 10 kings have not received a kingdom. And so, in other words, they are not the predominant superpower. But they are using their resources to funnel into the dominant superpower. And they are hoping for a little, you know, quid pro quo. You gotta speak a different language, speak it right. Ambition, greed, lust for power, those were contributing to Rome's downfall. Because when you've got a superpower the size of Rome, it's hard to keep everybody in check. And eventually, it's going to fall apart. 1 hour indicates it will be short-lived. We see that throughout the book of Revelation. We see that throughout chapter 18, the next one that we're going to look at, which is going to detail this further. Still, it was absolutely awful, the persecution that they went through. Cornelius Tacitus was a Roman historian who hated Christians. I mean, he circulated rumors about Christians. He was awful. But he is helpful as an extra-biblical source to understand what's going on during this point in history. He says about persecutions by Nero, he says, a vast multitude of Christians were not only put to death, but put to death with insult. They were either clothed in the skins of wild beasts and then exposed in the arena to the attacks of half-famished dogs, or else dipped in tar and put on crosses to be set on fire. And when the daylight failed, to be burned as lights by night. Now he starts saying after this, actually, as you continue reading in his annals, he talks about how the mindset among the Romans actually started turning in favor of the Christians. They're like, man, that's pretty bad. That's pretty harsh. Why are you treating them like that? And that sometimes is why God allows evil and wickedness to, in the grand scheme of things, accomplish greater good than what is accomplished by the temporary evils of history. Now, they have one purpose. From a human standpoint, if everybody's united, good or bad? From a human standpoint. From a human standpoint, it's good. But then you think about Babel, the Tower of Babel. They were all united, right? And that was a problem. So you start thinking about this idea of one purpose. Unity is not necessarily a good thing, especially when it is with evil intent. And it made me think about in World War II in particular, where you've got the Axis powers. The Axis powers were united in a general sense, but they were evil. I mean, millions of people killed because of this unity. Rome had no power outside of the role of client kings, like the Herod family. The power they wield is at the beast's disposal. So emperor worship was most popular in the provinces. They want people to worship the emperor from afar, so they keep sending in their tax money. Because if they're not sending in their tax money, then you as a superpower are going to go bankrupt. And so they wanted to make sure that everybody was feeding into their power. And that's what they did for a time. The integrity of this unity is compromised. So you think about with Daniel 2 in the fourth kingdom, there's no adhesion, there's no true unity. There's no integral strength because it's clay and iron, and they don't bond to each other. That's what happened with Rome. Verse 14, this collaboration will be definitively overcome by the Lamb, no matter how united they can become. The King of Kings has control despite the bloodshed of the saints and the gloating of the civil powers. And again, verse 16, my favorite. Allied with the harlot, yet they cannibalize the harlot. And that's exactly how Babylon is described in the Old Testament. Desolate and naked are Old Testament punishments specifically for idolatry. And what's happening in Rome? They want people to worship the emperors and worship pagan gods. So it fits the bill. These rebels seem to always self-destruct. The Midianites in Judges chapter 7, they turned against themselves. Remember Gideon and his men? They turned against themselves and killed each other. That has happened over and over again. Jehoshaphat, I believe, is that reference in 2 Chronicles 20. Verse 17, God has real power despite earthly appearances and deceptions. His unity is true. His unity and his purpose will rule the day. So compare the words of God, which will be fulfilled, versus the blasphemies of the enemy. We've got the words of God being consistent, faithful, true throughout the book of Revelation, set in opposition to the blasphemies of the beast and the harlot and all these other agents of Satan. I've got two more thoughts here, and then we'll pause for a final solicitation of questions. Here's an application for us, because you're looking at this and you're like, okay, that speaks to them and their situation. What about us? And I think this is going to get back to what Louis's comment was earlier. Satan has three approaches by which he seeks to destroy the work and people of God. Political or brute force, symbolized by the beast out of the sea. Have politics ever become between Christians? Yes. You betcha. Number two, false religion, whether paganism or perverted revealed religion, apostates who hold and teach false doctrines symbolized by the beast out of the earth. Have people ever apostatized within the church and led others astray? You betcha. Number three, the world of lust, all that appeals to the flesh or the mind, represented by the harlot. Has lust ever led the church astray? You betcha. Against these three, the early church waged relentless war, and against these, the saints of today must stand immovable and uncompromising. Amen? Amen to that. One last thought here. And that is just a reiteration of chapter 17, verse 14, which says, these will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, because He is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with Him are the called and chosen and faithful. God's kingdom will rule the day. Tom. Yeah.
That's just a small part of that picture as well. Just everything they're doing is so backwards from what we're supposed to do.
Of course. Absolutely. It does make you think about the ego trips of the emperors. What fed those ego trips? The people. Did anybody else have a comment? John Reeb?
You mentioned World War II. That verse where it says that one evil empire will cannibalize the other. In World War II, Nazi Germany and Russia, Communist Russia, signed a non-aggression pact that they wouldn't attack each other. But as soon as Hitler saw an opening, he attacked Russia. And think about the harlot with gold and impressive look. And have you ever seen pictures of Nazi rallies with thousands and thousands of people lined up in neat rows with their arms with that Hitler salute, and the backdrop to the podium was impressive to match.
Yeah.
But when Berlin was finally can see was they hung the concrete off of these magnificent buildings hanging down in construction everywhere. So, you know, and then right after World War II, Russia became our enemy. They were our friend by default earlier, but at the end, they became our enemy. So it's, you know, one nation like that, just to pray on the beginning weakness of the other nation.
Absolutely. That'll be it for today. Thank you for the class, everyone. Thank you for your comments. We'll plan on covering chapter 18 next week.